Hi, everyone, and welcome to this audio conference training for Rural Grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. The title of our call is For Our Non-Native Relatives, Strategies to Help Strengthen Responses to Native Women Who Are Battered. Our goal today is to consider how to remove service barriers and build effective relationships in Indian country to enhance victim safety. And I'm Liz Carlson. I'll be the host for today's call. I'm joined on the line by our guest speaker, Vicki Abanas, the founder and director of Red Wind Consulting and a longtime friend and ally and trainer for Praxis. So I'm thrilled. I haven't been able to do a training with Vicki for quite some time. She was a regular audio conference trainer for Praxis, and there's been a little lapse with that. So I'm thrilled to welcome you back, Vicki.
Oh, it's good to be back.
So I'm not going to take any time away from Vicki's training by introducing her today because I believe you all should have received her bio in the binder of materials for the discussion. And so, Vicki, if you don't mind, could you start us out by just further introducing yourself a little bit and, you know, familiarize us with the topic and kind of get us grounded in your training today?
Yes, I can. Thanks, Liz. And I do want to just comment, it's nice to hear your voice because I've missed doing these calls with you. As Liz mentioned, my name is Vicki Abanas, and I work with Red Wind Consulting. I am Diné, Hickory, Apache, and Mexican, and have been involved in this work probably for about 25 years. And through that work, I've did a lot of work in Duluth, Minnesota, and then over the last 10 years my work has been primarily national work, working with rural grantees and other programs through the Office on Violence Against Women. And Red Wind, the organization I work for, we are a tribal technical assistance for OVW through the Grants to Tribal Governments program. So I work a lot with the tribes in different parts of the country, and over the kind of the history of my work to end violence against women and in particular Native women, I've worked with a lot of our non-Native partners, either surrounding programs or that are involved in sharing some responsibility for the responses to end violence against women, as well as non-Native women who are working for tribes. So I believe in the process have had a lot of experience in thinking about how to help strengthen the responses for Native women in a way that's working in partnership with our non-Native relatives so that we create systems responses that are the most helpful. So over the course of the time that we have today, there's in the packet of materials that you received, there's a PowerPoint in there, and I'll be kind of following that PowerPoint. And so as I'm moving through the slides, I'll say next slide or slide number four or maybe even the title of it so that you can help follow along with it. And I'm not going to hit every single point on a slide. To me, usually when I train, slides are more of kind of a supporting piece as opposed to the core, so I'm not kind of a reader of slides or anything like that, but we'll be focusing kind of in that general area. And I really do want to hear questions and comments from all of you. One of the things that I really believe when I've worked with my non-Native relatives in this work, that oftentimes there's kind of a hesitance to ask some of the questions because a person who is not Native might be perceived as, you know, have maybe not asking it in quite the political correct way, or maybe, you know, I should know this, and, you know, if I ask this, people will know I don't know it, whatever. And I think that for me, when I do these trainings, this is a place for all of you to kind of let that guard down without judgment, to ask your questions, because I think it's important to just kind of figure out what it is you need to know and move through some of that. And I realize an hour and a half isn't a long enough time to really get a lot of depth, but at least we can open some of it up, and I just want to hope that all of you can feel comfortable in asking your questions and getting your own needs met as we move through the different areas. So I'm just going to jump right in, and one of the biggest pieces, like when we move into slide number 2, it starts off with no right is most more sacred. And I'm going to read this because this is a real powerful statement for me. No right is more sacred to a nation, to a people, than the right to freely determine its social, economic, political, and cultural future without external interference. The fullest expression of this right occurs when a nation freely governs itself. And I like having this quote because it really speaks to tribal sovereignty. And when we think about working with Native women who have been battered, we are really talking about a very unique population of people. And so a lot of times people will say, well, in communities of color and, you know, and include Native women as a part of that. And while on some level that fits, there's a whole other difference around the unique legal status that Indian people have between our nations, our tribal nations, and our relationship with the federal government. So we have this unique legal status that sets us aside and in a different category, if you need to put categories in place, from communities of color. So while communities of color will impact and look at issues of how people are impacted differently through bias and racism and institutional racism and different issues of oppression, when we talk about the sovereignty, we're really talking about a legal status, a nation-to-nation relationship that has been in place since the treaties have been started being developed back, I think, as early as in the 1700s, with the bulk of the treaties being formed in the 1800s. So we're talking about relationships that go back to colonization and through the process of colonization that follows it. And then with that, when we think about this right as being, you know, that there's no right more sacred than to be able to freely determine our social, economic, political, and cultural future, is really about saying that as Native people that we should be, you know, taking the lead and being involved in shaping and defining what we need and how that gets developed and how that gets put into place. And to me, that's really critical when we think about issues around violence against women, around domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, dating violence, all of the issues that we're focused on through our work with OVW, that one of the critical pieces is that a lot of the responses available to Native women come from mainstream non-Native programs and resources or even the criminal justice system that's really not designed in many ways to take up the unique challenges and issues that Native women face. And I'll get into more of some of that, those details as we move through. But to me, this is a kind of a core framing through talking about and thinking about non-Native relationships with tribes and Native women and responses for Native women around domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and dating violence. So moving on to the next slide, the historical context. One of the questions I get asked a lot is, why are we talking about something that's taken place hundreds of years ago? And there's some level of discomfort that I think some people have when they really understand the magnitude of what took place for the tribes. And sometimes there's feelings of guilt or, you know, even anger over, oh my gosh, I can't believe it was so bad, you know, this is horrible, why didn't somebody do something different? And so there's a lot of feelings that get generated around it. And at the same time, the piece for me about talking about the historical context for violence against women, Native women today, is really about understanding how it's playing out today. that when we look at the history of colonization and that whole process that took place from the onset of first contact to where we are today, there's a series of events that took place that had very significant impacts in the way communities are operating today. And also when we think about the historical context is that a lot of times people think about the history and the movement and the onset of colonization as coming from the eastern seaboard. And while that is the case, that there was a significant push of European settlers relocating to this land, there were several movements. It just didn't all happen on the eastern seaboard. There was a push that came up from the areas now known as Mexico and then also up into Alaska, crossing over through the Bering Strait and the Aleutian Islands and coming in from that direction. And so with these different pushes, there were different groups of colonizers that came in, which then have their own different unique local impact on tribes. But really importantly is the fact that prior to colonization, through our oral traditions, that there was virtually very little to non-existent violence against women. And even so far as that, many of our languages don't have words to talk about violence. And one example in working with some women up in the interior of Alaska, they were looking at their shelter responses and realizing that there was this kind of disproportionate response to Athabascan, I think it was Athabascan women, but Alaskan Native women in the interior. And as a part of that, they started looking at, so why is this that they're not serving very, very many of the women when they have such a large Native population in the area? And when they looked closer, what they realized was that Native women were coming in and saying, "He bothers me." And when you think about safety and a limited number of spaces, that the way a woman was framing, you know, the way she was describing what was happening didn't rise to the level of potential dangerousness, fear, all of those different kinds of things when we say, oh, this is an emergency, she needs an emergency shelter setting. But the reality was is that the woman or many of the women coming in were speaking, you know, their first language was their native language, and as speaking English as a second language. And so as they were communicating it, that they didn't have the language to talk about fear in an intimate relationship, to talk about dangerousness in that same kind of way. And that just gives you a little bit of an example of some of how we understand that violence against women didn't exist in our communities. And then also the other piece that was real significant was that we saw our communities as being intact. And in that meaning that everybody had a role and a responsibility, and there was a broad level of community accountability to ensure everybody was doing what they were supposed to be doing. So if somebody acted inappropriately, the community then itself responded in ways to where the consequences were firm enough to where people basically didn't act out inappropriately in the communities. And if they did, the rest of the community stepped forward and held them responsible. And the consequence was large enough that other community members were sure to not act inappropriately because they knew what the consequences would be. So through the process of colonization, what happened was there were several different things that started to erode the tribal values as well as create a breakdown to what I call an intact community. And so with that, there were a series of different events, and one of the really significant events had to do with boarding schools, which was an era that took place about a century long. And that was a policy of forced removal of children, pulling the children from their homes and their communities and placing them in boarding schools. And the intent was to assimilate the population so that the belief was that it would actually be more economical in the long run to assimilate. And in that process, what's happened is we have multiple generations of people who were actually raised in boarding schools. And so when you think about your own family and what you get from growing up in your family, from your parents in terms of the teaching that they teach you, the forms of affection that you receive in your own family home, and then the connections to your grandmother and your aunties and your uncles, and even just the neighborhood connections, that children through multiple generations were being raised by institutions and were missing some of that very close, intimate, gentle affection that teaches you what it means to be a member of a family, what it means to be a sister, a mother, a daughter, you know, a husband, a brother, and all of those different dynamics that comes with being a member of a family, and which then becomes a member of a community. So that is very, very significant. And then with that, then there was also some of the relocations that took place with tribes being moved from their tribal lands. And then with that, then the loss of some of the basics in terms of sustenance and being able to sustain yourself and being moved into a land that in some cases didn't have what you needed to sustain yourself, which created a level of dependency on some of the federal agencies to provide food and items to care for the families and for the tribe as a whole. And so then with that whole process, then also came, as that whole process was moving forward, then, as I mentioned before, that the treaties were taking place in the 1800s. And a real significant piece about treaties is that the treaties were arrangements, agreements in a government-to-government relationship. So between a tribal nation and the federal government, the two governments signed treaties and made some agreements to some things. And with that then came, wasn't that the federal government says, we're going to give you these things. It basically was that the tribes were saying, we're going to give you these things. And in exchange for what we give to you, you agree to take care of certain kinds of responsibilities. And I think that's a really significant piece because it carries through today where there's a misconception that the federal government is taking care of the tribes and not recognizing that this really was an agreement that the federal government entered into with the tribe, and in exchange for what the tribe gave to the federal government or to the United States, then kind of as payment for that, the federal government has assumed some levels of trust responsibilities. And the treaties themselves vary from tribe to tribe, so one treaty is not the same as all treaties. And so depending on the areas, there's different sorts of things that tribes agreed to give to the federal government, and in exchange, there were exchanges for that. And then two other points I want to make before moving on to the next slide. One of them is the Indian Child Welfare Act, which starts coming into effect somewhat in our work around domestic violence and sexual assault. And so the Indian Child Welfare Act is in response actually to the boarding school era, because even though the era itself ended in the 1950s, there continued and still continues today to be a practice of higher removals of children. And so when we think about when a child protective system gets involved in a family, and then that system moves toward a termination of parental rights, that what we see is that there's a history, a more recent history, where there's a higher percentage of termination of parental rights of Native children than there are of other populations. And so the Indian Child Welfare Act was an outgrowth in a way to protect the cultural and tribal identities of Indian children. So then when a state moves toward terminating those rights, one of the things that has to happen is there has to be a notification to the tribe so that the tribe has the ability to step in and assume authority over that case. And that law, that federal law, in some cases is still not being implemented today. So when we're working with women and then there's custody issues going on, there's a lot of times that, particularly because a lot of non-Native people don't understand that law, aren't stepping forward and taking the steps necessary to help ensure that that gets taken care of. And then the other one I wanted to mention is the Religious Freedom Act. And the significance of that for me is about that the Indian Religious Freedom Act was passed in 1978. And it speaks volumes in terms of the struggles of Native people, going back to that original first slide about no right is more sacred, to freely determine social, economic, political, and cultural future, that in 1978 it finally became legal for Native people to practice our own religions. And so when you think about the United States of America being founded on religious freedom as one of the core values that have been carried forward through the Constitution and different laws in our country, that it took till 1978, which I'd already graduated from high school by that time. Some of you may be quite a bit younger, but to me that gives a little bit of a framing to understand how some of this starts flowing into today, which that issue around religious freedom shapes a lot of views around different ceremonies and cultural practices and how tightly protected they are from people outside of the tribe. All tribes vary, and depending on the ceremonies and cultural practices, some of them are held tighter in protection than others are, and a good deal has to do with religious freedom and trying to preserve cultural, spiritual, religious practices of the tribe through centuries of not being able to legally practice. So I'm going to move on and go very briefly through these next two slides because I want to give us a chance to talk here briefly. But I wanted to mention different features of oppression that I think that when I talk about that whole historical framing, that we have to realize that oppression is playing itself out. And some of this connects to what we're talking about around communities of color and that there are differential impacts between systems responses. And so when we think about that, I know I work with law enforcement officers and they say, well, we're colorblind, we don't see color, we do the same thing for all people. The reality is that the same thing for all people doesn't necessarily have the same impact. And so when we think about how oppression plays itself out, being pervasive, restricting, hierarchical, and how it's just woven throughout our society, that we have to really understand the history of the historical context for violence against Native women, as well as how that is, some of that is integrated into our systems response. And when we don't stop to look at this differential impact and come with a colorblind approach, what we end up doing inadvertently while trying to be completely egalitarian and responsible to not discriminate, that in our attempts to be colorblind, and colorblind, I say that kind of loosely, that we inadvertently end up having different impacts that can potentially be harmful from one group to another group. And in particular, when we think about the government-to-government relationship between tribes and the federal government, if we aren't understanding that and how that plays itself out and making the connections to different features of oppression, then we start to, we don't necessarily start, but we continue to reinforce and participate in a system that isn't working well for Native people. And so thinking about that is that when we think about sovereignty, and I'm on slide 5 now, that we have to recognize that tribal sovereignty and the government-to-government relationship, and with that, that a Native woman's sovereignty is connected to her tribal sovereignty, and the two cannot be separated. And with that, I think it's our challenge as we look at creating our local responses to really understand what sovereignty means, and in that, being able to work with a Native woman from where she walks in her own path. And we'll get into a little bit more detail about that after we stop for some questions and comments. I want to talk a little bit more about some of the differences between Native women, because it's also not a real simple approach in terms of what you do for one Native woman, you do for all Native women. There's differences between tribes. There's differences between layers of assimilation that a woman may have. For instance, in one case, you might have a woman who's very closely connected to her own traditional teachings and spiritual beliefs, and it's a real important part of her healing process to be connected to her ceremonies. And there might be another woman that, as a result of the boarding school era and the role of churches that they played, she may be walking a very devout Christian path and be in, have beliefs that are in total contradiction to her tribe's traditional teachings. And so to assume that a woman is walking traditional will miss that other connection that comes with, you know, this woman who has another reality. And it's important to recognize that it can be one or the other or a whole range in between. But let's just go ahead and stop now. To allow a little bit of time to take some questions or to hear some comments.
So, Carrie, can you tell the listeners how to open up their individual lines?
Sure. Did you want me to just have them unmute themselves if they have a question or line up the question queue?
If you would line up the question queue, and then they can each come in individually.
Okay. If you have a question, then all you need to do is press the number 1 once on your phone, and those questions will be answered in the order that they're received. Let's give just a few moments to see if anybody gets in that queue. Again, it is just press the number 1. Okay, we do have a question from DVCC. Your line is open.
Yes, my question is, and I guess maybe you may have discussed it, but we seem to see in our area a lot of that level of dependency on non-Native systems, and we see most of our clients that we see are Native Americans, and so we're looking to see, because when you made the statement that the systems aren't really set up for Native American women, I guess I'm looking to see, and you may cover this in a little bit in the presentation, but what type of practical strategies or mental thoughts that we need to have in order to be able to more effectively meet the needs of our Native American clients.
Can you tell me, so when you're from DVCC,
mm-hmm.
where are you located?
In Minot, North Dakota.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I ask is because different parts of the state, there's so many different challenges and realities.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking about the system's responses that don't meet the needs of Native women.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking about domestic violence in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So as we look at a response, oftentimes the system that we use for offender accountability is the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, the non-Native coordinated community responses are not looking at the federal level.
Okay.
And so one of the huge challenges, and the reason I bring in the federal level, so when you look at a coordinated community response, one
mm-hmm.
of the things is the law enforcement response. Then you have, you know, the prosecutorial, or you might have the jail in there.
Mm-hmm.
Dispatch might also be a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
You have the offender accountability arm, which is probation and batterer intervention or batterer education programs,
mm-hmm.
As well as then the advocacy piece carries a real central role in there.
Mm-hmm.
More times than not, in my experience with working with non-Native programs, people don't understand how the federal piece plays out.
Mm-hmm.
And so some states are public law 280, which I'll touch briefly on that here shortly. So I'm not going to get into that. But mainly when public law 280 doesn't come into place,
mm-hmm.
if the crime happens, if the assault happens on tribal lands,
mm-hmm.
Depending on the level of the assault, it moves into a federal response. Always when we're talking about a sexual assault, if we're talking about a rape, always we have a federal response. And with that, when the advocates don't understand the federal response and the coordinated community response
mm-hmm.
isn't talking about how do you communicate and cooperate across the multiple jurisdictions and the state, you know, state/county, tribal, and federal agencies, then you're totally missing one aspect of response for Native women.
Okay.
So that's one example. The
uh-huh.
another side is I'll talk a little bit from the advocacy side, is that depending on the woman herself, so say, for instance, she's coming in, so the assault took place and somehow she ends up being brought into the shelter.
Uh-huh.
And as a part of that coming in and the process of being there, if advocates aren't really understanding her as a woman and
mm-hmm.
the local culture, there are some
mm-hmm.
things that may not fit well in terms of shelter rules. One example, and I've worked in both non-Native shelters and Native shelters myself, doing direct services and then from the administrative sides as well. And one of the things, I was working up in Ojibwe country up in northern Minnesota, and one of the things that was really clear was that women relied on other women being involved in helping to teach and discipline children,
mm-hmm.
Native women did. But then the non-Native women were really clear, don't tell
mm-hmm.
my child what to do. I'm her mother. You don't get to talk to her about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so right away you have a conflict in terms of beliefs
mm-hmm.
between what this non-Native woman believes around parenting and what a Native woman believes around parenting. And then the shelter itself might have the structure of that it's clearly each woman's sole responsibility to care for her child. So then you have a belief that's in conflict between the woman, the Native woman, and the shelter rules. Which then sets up a dynamic where the Native woman starts to become a problem person.
Mm-hmm.
And so by being able to understand some of those things and create a rule that's going to meet her needs as well as the other women's needs is more helpful and gives her a more positive experience while she's there.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a couple examples off the
mm-hmm.
top of my head. Is that
okay.
helpful?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, Vicki, this is Liz. I think that is really important context for consideration for programs. And maybe you will cover the more kind of practical, hands-on steps that programs can take to kind of begin to this process, to apply that context and to make the revisions within their own systems to reduce the barriers and to build the relationships with Native women. So is that a little later on in your presentation?
Yes.
Or?
Yes.
Okay.
We'll talk in more of that. And then as I talk about some of that things, I'll work at giving more examples. And then we'll definitely have a few more opportunities for questions and comments, too.
Okay, good. Carrie, are there any other questions?
There is one more. It comes from Flathead City County Health Department. Your line's open.
Great. Thank you so much. I've got a Native American woman that I'm working with, and, you know, you're talking about how important it is for her to be connected with her tribe and her culture. And she, the reservation where she's grown up is about 90 miles away, and she's living here now, and she's really cut herself off from her family, her friends, because of domestic abuse, because of sexual assault, because of extreme alcohol abuse with everybody that she knows, including herself. She's working to be sober, and her husband, who's incarcerated because of alcohol and will be getting out this winter. And she's going to a very conservative fundamentalist church, and she's so isolated. And I don't know if you're going to be talking about alcoholism, or I really want to support this woman, and I want to do a good job of that. So I don't know if you have anything to say to that. But just that separation, that she's trying to do the right thing and trying to stay sober, and at the same time she's cut herself off from her whole culture.
And where are you located at?
I'm in Kalispell, Montana, up in the northwest corner.
Okay. Well, and I think that the situation that you present really is something that I think a lot of women, not all women, but a lot of Native women struggle with as a part of, you know, when I did that historical context and that, you know, through the erosion of tribal values and kind of the imposition of different belief systems and just different things into tribal cultures, that that there's been this breakdown in the communities. And with that, then sometimes it puts a woman in a place where in order for her to take care of herself, whatever that means to her, sometimes she has to walk away from all of it. And right or wrong, you know, that's something that women see as the only option. The biggest thing for me in working with women is helping her to see more options.
Okay.
And one of the things, like when you were describing the situation, it made me think of some women that I come in contact with down in Phoenix. I travel a lot, and there's a group down in Phoenix that it's like a, and I'm drawing a blank on the name right now of the organization, but it's a program that works with women who are creating major changes in their life, you know, and so while there's a heavy focus around job and career, there's also a lot about personal identity and who you are as a woman, women's empowerment project.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been in town doing a training with a state coalition, and from there I met a few of the women, and they had a group of Native women who they were serving, but they felt like there was a disconnect for them. And so they asked me if I'd come and do a group for them, so I did. And in talking with some of the women after the meeting, what was really clear was that when they turn to non-Native programs in the area, that oftentimes they didn't know what else they could do.
Mm-hmm.
And as a part of that, realizing that sometimes it's not always just about reconnecting with their tribe only, that sometimes it's about trying to find ways to connect with other Native women,
mm-hmm, okay,
who might be in similar shoes. And, you know, like there's times that you might have a reality in your life and you don't get, you know, you're isolated with like what you describe. And then once you get in a group with a small group of women and you start talking and you start realizing you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so by being able to have settings where Native women can come together to be able to talk about their own realities really helps in a lot of ways for them to find some of their support. And then also for non-Native programs to really look at what are the other resources we have out there.
Yeah.
To be, and then with that, I think there's a whole process of how we do advocacy around really engaging in a woman in exploring her options. And so while she may be connected with a fundamentalist church, that may be one option of several other ones, but she may not be able to see them until she gets some help kind of supporting her through a process of exploring them.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So is that it for questions?
At this time, there are no further questions.
Okay, great. So I'm going to move on into slide number 8, important laws, which gets into a little bit of what I touched on about public. I mentioned briefly Public Law 280. There's a few really significant laws that come into play for tribes that are real specific and unique to tribes. And so as we think about understanding some of the stuff around who has jurisdiction, how is that playing itself out, understanding some of these laws is important. And the Major Crimes Act is one that came about in about 1860 or I think 1870, somewhere in that range. And it was a law that was passed that basically says in the cases of rape, murder, and mayhem, the federal government has jurisdiction. And there's, I would encourage people, if you're interested, to understand more about the story of how that whole thing came about. Google search Major Crimes Act, and you'll come up with some information about it. But it really, it played itself out as a result of the tribes asserted their authority in a situation, and the settlers in the area really reacted to how things were handled. And as a result of the reaction, Congress passed a law, and the Major Crimes Act came about. So the challenge then is, and that the Major Crimes Act is still in place. So when we're talking about so in the cases of a rape situation that took place on tribal land, the federal government has jurisdiction on it. Now, that doesn't take away tribal jurisdiction. It means that the federal government has jurisdiction, and the tribes could also prosecute at the same time. So it's an important thing to understand on a local level how that happens and who's prosecuting and who's advocating with the prosecutor, who's advocating with the law enforcement responders in there. And then Public Law 280 is a situation that came about in the 1950s where the federal government transferred, went through kind of a little bit of an experimental phase and transferred its jurisdiction in a few states over to the state. So Minnesota, for one, is a state with Public Law 280 where jurisdiction was transferred from the federal government to the state government. So in cases like rape, murder, and mayhem and crimes on tribal lands, then again, the state would have jurisdiction in there. But the tribe would still have jurisdiction. So if the tribe has an infrastructure, criminal justice infrastructure to be able to respond, they still have jurisdiction. So it doesn't mean that in that transfer it took away tribal jurisdiction. And the other one I want to mention is Oliphant v. Suquamish. And that's huge because that passed in 1978. So again, not too awful long ago. And with that, the Supreme Court negated tribal jurisdiction over non-Indian defendants. So, for instance, a non-Native person who engages in a criminal behavior on tribal land, the tribe does not have jurisdiction. So if a woman, a Native woman, who it might be in a relationship with a non-Native person living on her reservation, he batters her, the tribe has no jurisdiction. So what that does then, it takes all crimes, not just the major crimes, but all crimes committed by a non-Native, it takes that to the federal level. Now, this, what makes it difficult and challenging is the fact that then the federal response is very under-resourced. We have a huge challenge with getting rape cases prosecuted. There's such a backlog of with the Quantico lab, the FBI lab sending evidence in. I was working with a BIA officer down in Arizona recently, and he was saying that he has cases that are open, that his oldest case is like 7 years old, that he's still waiting on the evidence to be processed. And that isn't necessarily the truth in all areas, but that's one example of how problematic this is with the federal level. And so the challenge for us is to make sure that as we're looking at criminal justice systems responses, we have somewhat of an understanding, so when we're doing our systems change work and our advocacy work locally, that we're really working to get systems responders engaged in communicating with each other, cooperating with each other, and tightening up all of these big gaps in the system. The next slide, on slide 8, the Native Women's Research Project. Back in 99 and 2000, Mending the Sacred Hoop, as well as several local programs in Duluth, Minnesota, conducted a research project looking at the criminal justice system's response to Native women in Duluth, Minnesota. And out of that research project, which primarily there was a significant number of Native women who were involved in the project themselves, they saw four key values that were missing from the criminal justice system's response: honoring our relationships, being holistic, respecting women, and operating with integrity. And when I think about how we try to incorporate responses, is really trying to think about, as we're doing our work, how are we, you know, honoring the relationships of Native women, you know, recognizing that the all of the different ways that family is defined in a tribal community, being holistic in our response so that we don't have her fragmented into so many different pieces, and really respecting her as a woman and all of what that means, and then operating with integrity so that we actually follow through and really take things to task in a way so that as we think of criminal justice, that we actually are seeking justice. And with that, making sure that everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing. So in thinking about all of those pieces, that there are some things that we can do as advocates. While the system itself is huge and trying to find ways to create responses that are going to be the most effective and the most helpful, and recognizing that there's so much work to be done. So when we think about it, we want to look at, you know, so what is in place already? From a criminal justice system's response, but also from a service level or an advocacy level. And a lot of our work, we talk about doing a social change work. You know, to me, that's also a part of it. When we look at the mechanisms in place, I want to look at all of the different aspects of it. What's happening there? Who's cooperating with who? Who else should be involved with that? And then with that, recognizing, going back to that first slide about recognizing that we should be freely determining what it is that we need, I think it's really important that when you're working in and around a tribal community, that you draw from the tribe, that you recognize that they are your experts in helping to teach you, not the women who are showing up for services, but the other service practitioners that are in the community. And I say that because I have had experience where I've worked with people and they say, well, you know, I'm learning from women as they come in. We always do. We always learn from women as we come in, but that's not who we should be relying on. Because as women are coming in, she's coming in crisis. So we need to be working more proactively in ways to be ready for when she comes. So if we know we've got three tribes in our surrounding area, then we want to know what programs do they have in place, what kind of services are they offering. And then with that, you know, making the drive, hopping in the car, going over, you know, at, calling up, see if you can make, you know, schedule some time to go over and visit with them, to get a tour of their facility, spend some time building the relationship. That relationship is so important. And with that, that understanding what can they do, what kind of resources do they have, and where is their gap, and then in there, what, how can the two work together to bridge those gaps. But making that trip there once to visit their program isn't enough. It's really about, you know, reaching out multiple times to build that relationship. I know when, for me in doing direct services, I oftentimes, like when I start a new job, I start figuring out, well, who's doing what? What are the programs out there? And someone will hand you like a resource directory or something like that. And then oftentimes one of the things I'll do is I'll go and I will go and visit them. You know, even just sitting in somebody's office helps me to get a little bit more of a feel for what people are doing. By understanding what's happening on the reservation and the resources that are there, it doesn't necessarily mean that all the women you work with will go and work with the reservation, but it means that you'll know what kind of other options are available. And then sometimes it's they might have activities that maybe the woman doesn't want to be a part of the program, but there might be an activity that a woman might benefit from your program to go and participate in. For instance, I used to be the director of American Indian Community Housing, and we had a shelter, a transitional housing program, and a legal project for Indian women. And we were a tiny, tiny program. And in doing our work, there were a few other non-Native programs in the area that did some similar things, and they still served Native women. And when we would have our full moon ceremonies each month, one of the things that we would do is we reached out to the non-Native programs and asked if they had Native women who would like to join our women on the full moon ceremony. And it really helped in a way that it helped enhance their ability to work with the women they were working with. So they weren't providing the culturally, some of those cultural activities. The non-Native programs weren't providing those, but they had us as a resource so that the women in their program could reach out and participate in some of our cultural activities, which strengthened their capacity to serve Native women because the Native women felt a little more comfortable because they had other aspects of their needs being met. And then because of that relationship that we had built between our two programs or our, you know, multiple programs, because there were three other non-Native programs that we had partnerships with, and one of the things that they would do is they periodically, I would go over and do a cross-training with them. So I would do some stuff in service with their staff about some of the local issues, some of the stuff around the treaty, some of the stuff around some of the gaps in the systems responses, things like that. And then they also, in hand, through some of their resources, gave opportunity for some of our staff to be trained by their staff. So we really bridged a relationship where we actually were sharing our resources, which really expanded their capacity to work with the Indian women, and it expanded our capacity to work in the community on the issues we wanted to work on. So why don't we just stop here for a couple minutes and see if there's any questions or comments.
Okay, at this time, if you have a question, all you need to do is press the number one once on your phone, and that'll get you into the question queue. Give just a moment to see if anybody lines up in that queue. Okay, we do have a question from North Country Health Center. Your line's open.
Hi, this is Sandy Liston, and I am in Arizona. And for the past 12 years, I've worked with Navajo youth, but not with the women. And one of the things that I have seen with the youth is that the tribal traditions are not being carried on. And so they don't have an understanding a lot of times of those traditions, but the elders very much still hold to their traditions. And you had talked about in the beginning that there were language barriers and that they didn't have the words to describe. Can you talk a little bit about how that has moved forward, and do they have words now, and the separation between the youth and the elders, and how they're trying to bring back some of those traditions?
I think there's the language in terms of trying to find ways to describe domestic violence ends up being in English for the most part, or very detailed description. So, for instance, I was just recently doing some training with a group up in, it was across three or four tribes up in northern Washington. And one of the women were saying that as they were trying to translate some of their sexual assault materials into their local language. And in the process of doing that and working with the elders, what had ended up happening was that to be able to describe a sexual assault, it ended up being a very graphic detail of the act. And so they've been struggling with what do they do, and then decided to go ahead and use English words and then really work at educating so that people understand what those English words are because they didn't want to have pamphlets like that laying around. At the same time, and that's just an example, and I think that that's going to be a kind of a common issue in many areas where people are working with their language. I also know, like with the Zuni people, I've done a lot of work with them, and they teach the language at a very early age. It is a requirement in school, and I know that when I've been out there working with the domestic violence program, that pretty much all their staff speak Zuni. And with that, they have a radio station that they broadcast in both English and in Zuni. And the women had sent me some CDs of some of a few of the programs when they were highlighting some of their domestic violence and sexual assault work, and they had doctors and nurses and advocates on the station, and it was really interesting for me to listen to it. And I would listen to like 5 minutes in English and then 5 minutes in Zuni, and it wasn't exactly, you know, translated into Zuni. It was just different segments. Done in different, you know, in one language or the other. And so that was really exciting to see. And I also see a lot of tribes really doing a lot of work with the youth. And one example, working with the Rincon Rancheria down in Southern California, and they have an annual wellness conference that they do. And as a part of some of the work that they've done, they've engaged all of the school-age children for a very long time in school on talking about domestic violence, alcohol and drugs, and community responsibility, and just trying to really bring in discussions around tribal values and beliefs and kind of how some of these negative behaviors are in contradiction to traditional ways of doing things. And as a part of that, one of the things that they did was they engaged some of the kids in drawing a lot of pictures to describe some of the messages they would want to give to tribal council about how, you know, what they want for their communities. And then they took those pictures and they had an animator turn them into like little cartoons kind of thing, and actually did public service announcements for the community around domestic violence, about what the tribal council needs to do about it, about alcohol and how it hurts everybody in the family, and just all of these different things, and have really engaged the kids. And I actually had an opportunity to do, I was out there for their wellness conference, and I did a breakout session in partnership with a colleague of mine who works with men. And it was interesting, in our breakout session, we had probably about 30 people come to it, and we were talking about kind of a balancing between working with men who are offenders and use violence against women, and talking about working with women who have been victims of abuse. And probably half the people in our room were teenagers, and they were really actively engaged, and you could tell that they were used to exploring and talking about these issues. And I was just really impressed to see, you know, that over a period of time, and they had been doing the work already for a few years in their community, how they were actually making really positive change in terms of attitudes and views from some of the youth in the community.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Carrie, did you say there was another question on the line?
At this time, that was the only question in the queue.
Okay, great. So I have about 25 minutes left for the call today. So, Vicki, do you think you'll have time to stop one more time for comments and questions just before we end? Does that work?
Definitely, yes.
Okay, that's perfect.
I'll make sure we do.
Perfect, thanks.
Now we're moving on to slide number 11, how a Native person might collude with Native oppression. And I think it's important for us to really think about how it's important to really recognize all of our individual roles. When I talk about all of these systems issues, I mean, those are really big, and there's a whole piece of work that has to happen in there, but there's also a piece about individual responsibility. And I always think that as non-Native people who are working with Native people, there's a responsibility to understand a range of these different issues. And one of the key pieces is really, you know, being engaged in a learning process around sovereignty and what all of that means. And when you have a stronger understanding of it, then your responses start, it starts becoming easier for your responses to connect to and respect that sovereignty and uphold that sovereignty. Whereas when you don't have an understanding of it, then it's more of an easy thing to inadvertently kind of dismiss it or ignore it, or, you know, not take it into account. Another piece in there is around policies, procedures, and protocols. And, you know, that a lot of times, and this goes back to what I was saying about being colorblind, is that I think it's important that when policies, procedures, and protocols are being created, that if you have a population of Native women who are being impacted by those, that it's really helpful to have Native women or Native people review those to make sure that they're relevant, that they're appropriate, that they're helpful, that they don't inadvertently take you away from where you want to be going. And it doesn't have to be like a huge, big process. Like one of the things for me that in working with non-Native, like sister organizations and helping them think about their resources, I often tell them, you know, identify 2, 3, 4 practitioners, Native practitioners, and use them as your resource. And then from there, you might at some point say, okay, we're talking about shelter space. We're talking about a woman's space here, so we need to talk to Native women about what that does for them. And so it doesn't have to be a group of 10 Native women. It could be, you know, pull together 2-3 women to talk about some of it, you know, or have some mechanism so that you can ask women, you know, so what was the experience like for you? What would have been more helpful? Is there anything that would have been more helpful for you as a Native woman? And framing it in that way so that she can start saying, you know, this is what I need. This is what would have been helpful. And not that you respond to every single woman's request, but that you start to see the trends and the themes that are emerging from asking more than one person. And then thinking about as a message for our non-Native relatives, I think it's really important that you know yourself, you know, educate yourself, be engaged in the community. And when I think about that, know what it is that you feel uncomfortable with. So if you have very strong Christian beliefs and it feels in contradiction to really trying to support a Native woman about her own traditional teachings, then know that. I mean, you know, it's not to say that you put away your strong beliefs. Know that that's a barrier for you, and make sure that then what do you do instead of that? If that's an area that you feel yourself that you cannot adequately work well and thoroughly for this woman, then what's your plan B in there? And so as you know yourself, in some cases you can undo some of those pieces, and in other cases you want to have a plan B or a plan B and C to help strengthen the responses in there. I think it's really important also to educate yourself. One of the things that I think happens a lot of times is that there's an education that takes place and you understand some of what happens kind of on a broad sense, but don't necessarily understand some of the stuff locally. So, for instance, you know, if I say wounded knee, some people understand that, and that's kind of a kind of a common understanding of what took place with wounded knee, and understand the tragedy of it all. But the reality is, wherever you're located across the United States, there is a local story that you can draw from that is going to be fairly representative of what took place at Wounded Knee. And knowing the local story is the most important part. And in there, you know, some of it can be doing some searches on the internet to be able to understand that. Others is maybe, you know, listening to what people are saying or finding other people that can serve as teachers in there. The other piece I think that's important as a part of that local story and educating yourself is understanding when the local tribes got federally recognized, because that's a significant piece in there around the levels of assimilation and how things operate today. So, for instance, you could be in an area where the tribe has been, you know, federally recognized for the last century, or you could be working in an area where the tribe just got its federal recognition in the last 10 years, which is going to have an impact on the community, the resources that the community has and how it operates, which is actually going to help you understand more of why things are the way they are in the tribal community today. And then knowing the different experiences that Native people have, and again the local experiences, understanding how some of that plays out. For instance, I was down working with the Tona Atham down south of Tucson a couple years ago, and it was very interesting and important for me to understand how part of the tribal land moves down into Mexico. And so while you're working in Arizona, you know, and you have the state issues, you also have a tri-national situation going on there with the Tonopah as a nation having tribal lands in the United States as well as having tribal lands in another country in Mexico. And then with that, understanding that the Tonopah are also, some of them can be even trilingual. And that's not, you know, when you're in border areas, that's not going to be too uncommon. And understand how that plays itself out as well, in terms of some of the border issues with what's been going on with current anti-immigrant sentiment and how that impacts the tribe today. And then moving on to being an ally, which is just a little bit of a connection and a growth off of that message for our non-Native relatives, but really, really figuring out ways to understand today's realities in a community and how a lot of the realities aren't so much about the tribe not taking care of the people or the people not wanting to take care of their community. It really is an outgrowth of a history of genocide and colonization that runs very deep. And while we're working at creating changes, we're talking about century-long practices that we're trying to be undone. And in some cases, if a tribe just recently got federal recognition, you know, we're talking only a decade or a few decades of areas of being able to address this, or, in some cases, longer periods of time from that. And being an ally is, you know, one of the biggest things for me is about working with non-Native relatives, knowing that if I'm not in the meeting, if I'm not in the room, that my sister relatives that are out there doing this work too, you know, they're taking care of the issues as well, that it's not just because I'm present or, because we have to take care of the Indian issue because it's on the grant, or it's really about making this a priority, about making sure all women get served and these issues get addressed. So let's go ahead and take some time now to stop and open it up for questions and comments again.
Okay, if you have a question, all you need to do is press the number one once on your phone again. Again, that's just press the number one once. And we do have a question from DVCC again. Your line is open.
Can you explain, I guess I'm sure it will be in great length, but can you explain why alcoholism and depression seems to be very prevalent in Native American populations?
Well, alcohol is basically with the introduction of alcohol into tribal communities through the process of colonization and the different settlement that took place was a foreign substance. And in Native people's bodies had not adapted to it, and all of a sudden it's introduced. And so basically with that introduction, and when you think about how bodies change over time, the physical body hasn't assimilated that introduction yet. And so with that, there's still a huge, it's a huge foreign substance that's still as a part of alcohol that the body, you know, becomes it's a very addictive substance into the body, whereas in non-Native communities, alcohol has been a part of non-Native communities for, you know, thousands of years, actually. And so the body has assimilated that substance, or maybe it wasn't even a foreign substance. I don't know that. So with that, when we think about the introduction of alcohol, we're just talking a couple centuries ago. And interestingly, I'll tell you a little story about people up in Alaska. I have a friend who's Athabascan, and she's about my age in the early 50s. And she talks about seeing contact in her lifetime. And so she, in her village as a little girl growing up, they had never had non-Native contact. And then it was around when she was 16 years old that the first non-Natives came to her village. And right with some of that first contact, alcohol was brought. And so she actually saw kind of, she said when she talks about it, she talks about how it was just like, it was just like this whole wall, just all of a sudden everybody got slammed up against it with the way their bodies were reacting to this alcohol and how it just like took over the village, the alcohol did. Mm-hmm. And today with her village, now she's in her 50s, she, you know, it's a huge issue that everybody struggles with and struggle with trying to manage it. And, you know, dealing with the high rates of alcoholism and all of what goes with it. Now, depression also fits in there somewhat with alcohol as a depressant. And so you've got that side of depression playing in there. But then you also have this other piece that comes from the history of violence that's taken place, the history of oppression. When you think about prior to colonization, a little-known fact is that at the onset of colonization, there happened to be, in rough estimates, ranging between 20 million to 80 million Native people on this land. Hmm. So when you think about, and when I say this land, I'm not just talking United States, I'm talking North America. And so 20 to 80 million people, which I remember in grade school, it seemed like it was vast open spaces, like there was hardly anybody out there. But 20 to 80 million, that's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And then that's at the onset of colonization. And then if you go to the turn of the night or the 20th century, the early 1900s, there happened to be about 200,000 Native people in the United States. So we're talking 20 to 80 million down to about 200,000 people. Hmm. That's a genocide, mm-hmm, that's taken place with that. And so with that, in terms of what that means to your children, what that means to your value, what that means to your spirit. So there's this whole piece in there of layers that of hopelessness that's in there. And then for me, working on domestic violence and sexual assault, I'm doing a lot of work right now on sexual assault issues, and we're talking virtually no prosecution of rape cases. Mm-hmm. And so there's this hopelessness. So as a Native woman, you get raped. Mm-hmm. People say, report it. Well, why should you, if they're not going to prosecute with it? Why should you subject yourself to a forensic examination, or, you know, the fact that the information could go public? So then you have this violation, not only on your body, but on your spirit, on the very essence of who you are as a woman. And so you have that playing itself out as well. So we have this long history of both the issues around alcohol and depression, to me, which goes to that piece of what I was saying about being an ally, recognizing the impact of genocide and colonization. Thanks for asking that question.
Thank you.
It's not a very good answer. I mean, it's a hard answer to hear, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have one other question that comes from Help in Crisis. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm in Oklahoma. Do you have recommendations or strategies on coalition building? And you showed some, I was very interested in your bridge building among different organizations, but even among differing tribal entities that may not always be working on the same things with the same priority.
I always believe in starting small, and I think it's really important to build small, strong relationships as opposed to large, weak relationships. One of the things for me with tribes is really recognizing how tribes have so much work to do in terms of really addressing what the tribe needs. And it, sometimes it's hard to fathom it, you know, as a someone outside of a community to understand why isn't this an important issue. And the reality is that there are so many important issues. And I think about, you know, looking at domestic violence and sexual assault work, we are decades behind non-Native communities, decades. And when you think about the Violence Against Women Act and how long that's been in place since 1994, and, you know, resources are just getting out to the tribes in those responses. And that's one example of how slow the responses come. And so with that, then, there's also turf issues, and sometimes historically tribes were relocated and placed in proximity or even on the same reservations with tribes that weren't necessarily their friends. So they had more adversarial roles historically, and then all of a sudden they're thrown on a reservation and put in a position to have to deal with each other because of the different federal relocations. And so for me then, I think it's really important to find ways to build a small relationship across a few people who see it as a priority and really work at doing something solid there. Now, part of it then, like I think about when we were creating American Indian Community Housing, we were working across, we were working primarily with one tribe, but as a part of doing that, we're trying to work across seven tribes. And in that, each of the tribes were in different places economically as well as some of their internal kind of challenges, you know, some of the history, the stuff with alcoholism, some of the stuff with different health issues and diabetes and, you know, just all of the different kinds of things were different between different tribes. So as we were doing it, we started to work with the closest tribe and really built solid relationships with a small group of people, and then as we got that really solid, then we started with that small group to figure out from another tribe who else could we include. So then we included two more women from a neighboring tribe and started really incorporating them in a way to where they felt really a part of that group. And then from there, we brought in two more women from another tribe. And so we did kind of a building process. And then with that, really trying to find ways to really value each person there so that it wasn't about, you know, just show up to meetings for the sake of the meeting, but really recognizing what people had to offer so that it really was about, you know, really drawing from their strengths and what they had to offer as opposed to filling a seat at the table and that they happened to come from this tribe, and so we could, you know, check them off the list. So that kind of small building process, I think, was a really solid piece. And we ended up actually getting support from five of the seven tribes by the time I left. And I'd been doing that work for probably, it took us about 6 years to get that far. And I know that I'm in so close contact with the director from there, and they've been working across all seven tribes now. Is that helpful, or is there something else that might be helpful for you?
Concrete strategy. Thank you. That's very helpful.
You know, and one of the things that I think is important that gets overlooked is gifts. Is that that one of the things that I think is a really important part is about giving gifts. And from a professional side, it's a struggle, and I think non-Natives find a hard time thinking about, well, what can I, you know, how do I give them something? And I think about, I used to work here with the State Coalition in Colorado, and we're a rural state, and I was traveling all over the state, and it was interesting for me, and I was working with it. We have two tribes here in Colorado, and I was working with those two tribes. And as I was working with those two tribes and incorporating in some of the other areas non-Native programs in some of the other areas of the state that hadn't been visited for a while, that the non-Native programs were like, oh, my gosh, she brought me something. And I would bring, like, materials. So, like, one of the things that I know that Praxis has that's easy to get your hands on is they have really great public awareness materials. And they have some that are African-American-specific, they have Native American-specific, and then they have non-Native or, I don't know what you'd call it, mainly it focuses on white communities, but then they also have some Native and some Latino in there. And those materials were something that, from the coalition, we shared those materials generously with other programs, or actually I should say I did because I was the one who wanted to bring gifts. So when I would go and I would visit a program, I would bring them either a full set of the materials or a portion of the materials and share that with them as a gift, as you know, as opposed to bringing in, you know, like a piece of pottery or something. I would bring them something relevant to the work, something that I knew that was interesting, something that was visually attractive, and share those pieces. And the tribes that I worked with, they loved that, and it was something that I expected. And then I also would bring, I would also bring some syrups, you know, like a little bottle of syrup that I would pick up from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I would give them a bottle of syrup and a, you know, packet on public awareness materials on how to do a radio interview, and here's two posters, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
People loved that. And I know from a Native perspective that would be a really valuable piece of sharing some of those kind of resources. And I would do it in a slow, simple way as opposed to, oh, I can put together a whole big stack and give them all that.
Mm-hmm.
I would just kind of give a little piece here and another piece there, you know, things like that. If I had a meeting of a group of, you know, six or eight women, I would make sure that there was something special that the whole group got, you know, that everybody had the same, you know, as a part of being there,
mm-hmm.
that they walked away and, you know, it was like, oh, this is an important thing. This is good. I think that's another good, helpful thing to include.
Yes, well thought. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I should just interject that Vicki is very humble in how she talks about the Native public awareness campaign that we have on our website, and I'd encourage each of you to take an opportunity to look at it. She helped. She worked very, very closely and for an extended period of time with groups of women to kind of flesh out the ideas for that campaign and then ultimately to work with a graphic designer to identify the images and make sure that they really captured the spirit and the intent, and they're very beautiful.
It's my favorite. Thank you, Liz.
I always love them. We have them in our office now, and we are in kind of a community building, and so we have a number of people who come through who are Native and non-Native, and we often get comments on them and people interested in where they can find them and trying to share them. So take a look at them. At the very least, you'll be able to see the images on our website on the products page. If you just scroll down, you'll see it's a Native public awareness campaign, and they are very beautiful. So unfortunately, we are at the end of our time. This call has been so engaging and interesting, and I am so grateful to Vicki and to all of you for your participation. It really, I think your questions have really brought to light the information that Vicki was here to share with us, and so it's been a really good balance to me of both content and questions. So thanks to all of you. Vicki, do you have any kind of wrap-up that you'd like to do right now?
Not related to everything. I think there was a lot of information shared, and I just encourage you to just keep thinking about it and find places to talk about the different aspects of working with Native women. I do encourage you to look at those public awareness materials that are designed for the tribal communities, and in particular, I mean, it's always nice to look at the pretty pictures and the posters. The written materials, the accompanying booklet that goes with it, has some information in there, and it, one piece that we put in there was a message for our non-Native relatives, which kind of reiterates some of what I was talking about as well. There's some other resources that we listed with it, and then we just thought the posters were going to be so great, and Carrie conveyed such a beautiful message. So we actually even put together some discussion formats for using the posters to engage in discussions. So I think if you get a chance to look at them closer, really take a few minutes to think about how you can use some of that to engage in discussions. And I think that they're really appropriate to talk, from a Native perspective, but also for non-Natives to think about their own responses to the local tribal communities. And thanks, everybody. It was really great being on the call with you all and having an opportunity to talk about these topics. I find it really important and really appreciate that non-Native women such as yourself are concerned about these issues and choose to participate in this call.
Thank you, Vicki. It's so nice to have you back. Welcome home. Nice to have you on this call with us. Thanks to all of you for participating. Just a couple of quick wrap-up pieces. I'd encourage each of you, if you would, to take a really brief moment and fill out the evaluation, the online evaluation that is now available to you through SurveyMonkey. It's really a quick and easy process. So please try to find time for that. I'd like to also let you know that Vicki and I are planning next year to do two more audio conferences to kind of further, this is just a little bit of a foundation upon which we would like to have further training on both Public Law 280 and the Indian Child Welfare Act, which she didn't have time today to get into. So look for that publicity. Those topics will be coming up. Everybody, thank you so much. I look forward to talking with you again. And Vicki, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Take care, everybody.